Welcome to the RPG Design Panelcast, presenting the very best recorded panels and seminars about game design and publishing. These panels have been made possible thanks to the kind contributions of the panel speakers at Metatopia 2023. Episode 369, Staying In for the Long Haul, presented by McGay Baker and Vincent Baker.
Thank you all for coming.
Hi.
Hi.
So good to see you all. I'm Vincent.
I'm Meg.
And we've been doing this for a long time, and we're glad you're here to hear about it.
The panel we're doing is the Indie RPG Publishing for the Long Haul panel at Metatopia in 2023. And this panel is being recorded, so it'll be available online afterward, and that'd be great. I want to leave the doors open for a little bit more, but if the noise from the hall gets too much for anybody in terms of sensory overload, just let me know, and we'll try and mitigate.
All right. So we've been doing this for 25 years, give or take, and we have a million bullet points, each one of which is a story. We're not going to be able to cover everything, so we're just going to go through our history. We also, if I may, we also are not positive what's going to be interesting, what's going to stand out, what's going to catch your attention, or spark your
curiosity or questions,
exactly,
which we really want to get to.
So if anything stands out, please keep a note on it. Should we take questions after each time period?
Yeah,
will
let's
we
do
get
that
to the end if we do that?
Yeah, but let's be really mindful of our time.
All right.
Okay.
We will do our best. There's 25 years to cover. Oh wait, there's 50 years to cover.
So we were both born in the 70s, and the slides we have, which I'm not sure will be available for the audio viewers at home, this is a slide of the 70s and 80s, our creative communities, games we played, and our creative communities were family and friends in school, and the people around, whoever it was, the four other kids in our middle school who we knew and played games. The games we played were D&D and Robotech and Zork and a ton of homebrews.
So every time period, we're going to talk about the lessons we learned during that stage of our process, our development as creators and publishers. And so the thing I learned, my dad was an architect, the thing I learned is the flow of a project through the house. He would work with clients, he would bring in projects, he would work on them for however long they took, and then he would put them out the door. So I was raised with that process and that rhythm very familiar to me. And so when I started to take on projects of my own, I was familiar with the process of bringing in a project, finishing it, and getting it out the door.
Yeah, and now our kids think that it's a normal state of affairs to write a game and publish a book. So that's the generational process of learning how to take on rhythms, complete objects. The big thing I learned in the 70s and 80s was to fill notebooks with stuff. And make up stuff with friends. That it to me, it felt like an organic part of my childhood. This was nothing different or special or unusual, to just like make up imaginary worlds for fun all the time.
We met in
September 9th of 1990.
Yeah.
So in 1989, I was at college, and you joined me a year later. And this is the 1989 to 2000 slide. Our creative communities were college,
Games, FRP Advocacy, the old Usenet group.
Yeah.
We hung out. I especially hung out there in the mid 90s.
The Ennead was a group of people who played games a lot, and lived together, and played with all that group for years. Talk in Theory with Emily Kerr-Boss.
Yep, our dear friend Emily Kerr-Boss.
Yeah.
She wrote the romance trilogy, for those of you who know it.
Society for Creative Anachronism was a huge creative community for me. Again, like diving into how deeply you can create a character and how invested you can become in a different imagined space. I participated in the Tarot Art Quilt Project, in which textile artists from around the world made a tarot deck of quilts that were 2-foot by 3-foot quilts. It was an amazing project. It was my last year of college, and then 9/11
happened. If I may, Meg made the Two of Pentacles.
I made the Two of Pentacles and the Ace of Wands.
Oh.
Yep. And we were all in line to do a tarot deck and book and a show that would rotate, you know, go all over the country. It was awesome. And it opened in Chicago, and then planes flew into the two towers, and all of the funding and organization for that went away. So things happened, and then our Great Alien.
And in the 90s. We were, as small creators, as independent creators, we were alienated from the process of publishing games. The only way you could publish a game in the 90s was to print thousands of them. They had to be big hardcovers. You had to store them in your basement, wishing that Alliance would pick them up until they fell to rot and the mice ate them. And then you had a $30,000 credit card that was spent. We knew a lot of people. Well, we knew a few people who did that.
We called them heartbreakers back in the day, of people who had a dream and a vision and a game, and it was awesome, and they just wanted to do a thing. But this was before the advent of the things that we think of as commonplace now. A robust internet, PDFs, Patreon, all kinds of other ways to do IPR, all kinds of other ways to get your game out there. Games we played: Shadowrun, Tal's Lanta, Cyberpunk, Millennium's End, and Vincent and I played a decade-long Ars Magica game with Emily Kerboss. Yeah, oh my god, the best.
And there's a whole story about Millennium's End.
Questions? Like, do we want to do the? Oh yeah, okay.
Let's do this.
Yep.
So during that time, we also got married. We had kids. We had by 2000, we had our second baby. By 2000, while we were still struggling to figure out what to do for a livelihood.
Always a true thing. Always a true thing. Developing creative partnership from the very beginning, and through having kids, and through working, and through my work with Mother Language, was for 12 years I did support work for families dealing with postpartum depression, anxiety, stress. And like building communities, finding communities, was a big part of that time. In terms of creative partnership, it was a constant navigation of communication and defining communication always. Like that's part of how you stay in this for the long haul, is you practice and practice and reinvent communication with your creative partners, with your audience, with your business partners, with your colleagues. Always, you know, always your communication and relationships are never finished. Games we created in that time.
Yeah, we closed out 2000 with the first game that I ever felt comfortable putting whole in front of another person, which was the Cheap and Cheesy fantasy game, and it was cheap and cheesy. It was fine. No, it was fine.
It was fine.
It was fine.
Cheap and cheesy.
I illustrated it myself. I still do that.
The other thing that was important, though, in the games we created there is a lot of unfinished games that haven't ever seen publication. That work is never wasted. You know, the work you do can sit on a shelf for 30 years, and then you can be like, oh, there's the bit I need. So I don't consider those, you know, it's easy to think of an unfinished project as like wasted time. It's easy to think of an unfinished woodworking project or gardening project or textile thing is like, oh, I really gotta get to that. Files on the disk drive don't take up that kind of space. Lessons we learned.
So that's the Millennium's End story. I was working on a game in college where you had a overlay template for where you got shot, and then Millennium's End came out with that, and it was such a relief to just throw away all my work, because now I could just play the game instead of making it. Such a relief. It's good. It's always good when someone else makes your game for you. I know I have friends who feel bitter when somebody else makes their game, but I've never felt anything but relief when I could let a game go like that.
There's so many things that are hidden in that bit, in terms of lessons you learned, in terms of staying in it for the long haul. About there's constantly room for new movies and new music and new books and new everything. So there will be room for your new game. There will. You know, it's easy to be like, but someone's already wrote that. If you're like Vincent, you're like, oh, thank God, I don't have to write that. Awesome, it frees you up to do other stuff. But if you're worried that your game about, I don't know, skyfaring snail explorers is too much like other people's games about snails who explore the air, it's not.
It's true. From the Right Games FRP Advocacy Days, and from talking theory late at night with Emily Kerr-Boss all the time, we developed the beginnings of what would be our foundation in, like I say theory opinions, but our personal theory, our working theory, and our working theories of how games can work and how games should work, how games might work, what to test, what to try. And, you know, if I have one recommendation to people designing to start out is form those theories, commit to your own ideas as creators. You have a vision for how games work that is unlike anybody else's. And the better you can
embrace that.
Yeah, embrace it, articulate it to yourself. You don't need to write theory, but the better you can steer by your theories, the stronger your work will be.
There's some things that Vincent has said in the past about, you know, game design comes from having an insight into, you can articulate better, an insight into human beings,
yeah,
an insight into how games work. And there's a third piece.
An insight into your subject matter.
An insight into your subject matter.
Your explorer snails.
Yeah, your explorer snails. I love my explorer snails. Use every part of yourself is a lesson I learned in this time frame, 89 to 2000. Because I didn't, like... When we were in college, there was no game design major. You could not take courses in game design. It's astonishing to me now that there are. And so you had to use every piece. I used every piece of myself to design my games. Storytelling background, a childhood spent outside, a childhood spent with an alcoholic stepfather, a childhood spent with moving across the country multiple times. Incredible experience of dance in my background, being a textile artist, being a historian, being a sex ed teacher, all of these things come in. So use your whole self. It's easy, I think, more so now when you can take a course in game design, you can major or take a master's in or get your PhD in something related to game design. It's easy to, I think, compartmentalize that. Like, this is the piece. This is where I'm doing my game design work. I'm a game designer. Your whole self, bring your whole self. You will discover different places that inspire you. You will discover different mechanics because you allow it when you open yourself up to thinking about, well, how would I express this if I brought in my knowledge of my, I don't know, my military background or my caring for my elderly parents' experience or my, you know, the time I spent traveling with the circus that summer. Yeah, bring your whole self.
And we abandoned a million games in that time period because they weren't playable. We created a setting, we created game mechanics the way we all did in the 90s. But there was no groove. No, I'm not gonna. This is being recorded for the internet. If you
sorry.
Get me started
sorry.
Talking about the
Fruitful
Void, I will
we'll
say things that. No. The Fruitful Void is, well, I'm out.
That's part of have theory opinions. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What we're talking about here is leave room in your design for your players.
Yeah. And for play. For leave. You know what I'm talking about. I don't need to say
the example
that.
There is that we had a game that we designed and we loved, and when we brought it to playing, we realized that the setting was too complete. And it was like, oh, this is just a little heist in a setting. There wasn't room. All right, so now we can pause for questions. If there's questions so far, we had said that we would pause after each bit. Is there a question so far? We good? Over to you. Good? One question, yeah.
You listed Zork as one of the games that you played in 80s?
Yeah.
That wasn't like a tabletop version.
No.
No.
Zork was definitely not tabletop at that point, but boy.
All right, super quickly my Zork story. So my uncles had an Atari 800 computer that had Zork on it, and me and my uncles are about the same. My youngest uncles are about the same age as me. And so me and my youngest uncle would play Zork, but when his older brother needed the computer for homework or whatever, I would be the computer and Benjamin would be the adventurer. And that's how I started Roblox. And for the first day, I made him write out his little commands, and then I would write on the note paper my answers and hand it back to them. That didn't last very long, but that's where I started.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking.
All right, so now we're at 2001 to 2005. Our creative communities are the Western Mass game scene. This was wild. Someone asked us in that era, 2005 to 2007. So, okay, Megan Vincent, where do you live? How close is everybody else together? We had to say, well, Julia Ellingbo lives across the street. Emily and Epi live about half a mile walk. Joshua A.C. Newman and Evan Turner and Kat Jones are a 20-minute drive. Rob Bowl is a 25-minute drive. It was ridiculous how robust that
is. It was great.
Elizabeth Sampa.
Elizabeth Sampa, Shreya Sampa.
Sampa up the street, yeah.
They lived up the street from us. We had to, our game design friends started saying, hey, should we move to Western Massachusetts?
Not without and we a would game say, job.
If you have a job there already, then maybe. But
yeah.
Anyway. But it was great. We would do what we call the coffee and game design. This is Ebony Ravishaw's invention, coffee and game design, where he would say, I'm going to be at this cafe talking about game design to whoever is there, and anybody who wanted to would show up and we would talk about game design. We used to get coffee twice a week and call it office hours in the cafe. It was so good.
I recommend this highly. If you want to do this, do this. If wherever you are locally to your local scene, say, hey, coffee and game design, I'm going to be at this cafe hanging out, drinking coffee, and talking about game design with whoever shows up. Do it. It's wonderful.
I don't see how we can tell all these stories.
Well, we have to talk fast.
Yeah.
The Forge was huge. There was a lot going on there. Gen Con is a thing that happens.
I went to Gen Con for the first time in 2003 to sell games. It was a revelation.
I was also in this part of creative community. This is where you have to think outside of the people in this room or the people in the gaming community. What are your other creative communities? Do you have a community where you go hiking together or talk about makeup or build things with, you know, lathes? I was in a digital art community that was very, very robust in the early 2000s, making all kinds of pixel art. And it definitely helped in terms of lots of things that translate in terms of cultivating a good community. How do we behave together in a way that is respectful and responsible? How do we change the direction of narratives that have been challenging to ones that are more emancipatory? Look all over for your creative communities. Games we play are created.
I think you skipped. Okay. So, then I wrote Kill Puppies for Satan, and there's a whole story there. No, we can't.
Story.
We don't have time. No,
you
Kill Puppies for Satan.
You had to tell
somebody
about.
Asked.
What?
Somebody asked.
Somebody asked what?
Somebody asked Meg about Kill Puppies for Satan.
Please, somebody ask me about Kill Puppies. Thank you.
What's the story about Kill Puppies for Satan?
Okay.
You don't have time.
I had gone back to work after having our second child. It was my first day meeting Vincent at home alone with Meredith, who was at the time like 3 and a half, and Elliot, who was at the time 6 months old.
We were splitting dogs.
Yeah. This is part of the intentional choices in time versus money in our life together. So one of the things that we want out of this panel is to talk also about being creative partners. And it may not be a romantic partner or a householding partner, but there are a lot of people working in some sort of creative partnership and how you make those choices to support each other in that. We were very lucky very early on because we fell into this thing recognizing each other's creativity as a thing we would value in time and in money, and that we would trade that and say, this matters more to me than being at the office more. We never had office jobs. And this, you had an office job for a very long time. And that pulls into our time with our kids and our family. So we were trading off. We made a commitment to our kids to have a parent home because, you know, for various reasons.
Yeah, that's what we chose.
Yeah, that's what we chose. Anyway, I went back to work. I left Vincent with the 3.5-year-old and the couple-month-old that came home, and I said, "How was your day?" And Vincent said, "I made a game." And I said, "Oh, that's great, because, you know, making a game is a good thing. We do that. What's it called?" "It's called Kill Puppies for Satan." And I said, "Oh, you had a bad day." And then here's another piece about in it for the long haul. This is very, very important about in it for the long haul. Kill Puppies for Satan, we took the $60 we could afford to burn as parents of two young children working very, you know, we were not making money, you know? We had $60 we could
burn. Can I tell what that $60
please,
was?
Yes.
That was Ars Magica 4th edition, which I had already decided I would hate. This was 3rd edition, Ars Magica 3rd edition, the White Wolf edition. And I was like, I'm going to spend $60 on this, or I can choose to spend $60 to see how far $60 will take me publishing games.
Yeah.
And that's, we've been in the black ever since. That's all of our money that we've ever spent, was yeah. $60.
But so this is very important. If you want to be in for the long haul, figure out your budget for what you can afford to lose now. Don't lose more than that. We live in an age of Kickstarter, which is phenomenal and gives you a lot of space. However, there's a note there about don't lose your sanity. Finish your game first. Do not kickstart that you're going to be inspired. Okay? If I was in the middle of a Kickstarter right now that I was trying to like, oh, I'm going to make a game and I'm going to be delivered, and then I got a cancer diagnosis, and suddenly I'm like, oh, sorry. It weighs on you. It chews on you to have an unfinished thing. So finish your game first. Then
I am in the middle of delivering a Kickstarter. Yeah.
So it was then.
And this period ended with Dogs in the Vineyard, which was my breakout game. And that is in large part why we're here at all, is because of Dogs in the Vineyard.
We also learned a lot about playing with our family then. That games are for everybody all the time.
Oh, so during that time period, 2001 to 2005, maybe 98 to 2005 or whatever, PayPal came to exist. PDFs came to exist. People started publishing game PDFs. Print on demand, Lulu started.
Yeah. Game changers.
Yeah, and the publishing our own games became suddenly not only in reach, but actually in reach for a couple of kids with $60.
So we wound up in a place where, from it exactly countered the messages we've had as kids ourselves and as at like first Gen Con and things, and about that, like those Heartbreaker books where someone had invested not only all the design team time but all the money and everything to get those. Suddenly we had the means of production in our hands. Oh my God. And that's kind of I still get like, what? Because that's so cool.
Yeah. I want to say about design on purpose. So we printed, I don't know, 25 copies of Kill Puppies for Satan. We abandoned some on the doorsteps. It's a very funny game. We abandoned some on the doorsteps of the local game stores, never heard back from them. That's fine. It was a joke. But I sent one to Jonathan Tweet, who wrote Art of Magic.
Which we played for a decade.
Enormous fans. And he wrote me back, and I said, I got to tell you about our Ars Magica game. And he replied to me and said, I wrote Ars Magica for campaigns. I wrote Over the Edge for characters. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I did not realize you could design a game for something, for a reason. Designing a game on purpose so that it does something. And just that insight wasn't enough to tell me how to do it. But it opened that door where I was like, I gotta learn. I can't just be creating a setting and a system anymore. I gotta learn how to design on purpose.
Yeah, and that's, you know, like when you're designing something, it's okay if you're like, this is the game I'm doing for this reason, and this is the game I'm doing for this reason. My game 1001 Nights is about how to teach you to be a better GM and how to bring in more evocative different things, and how to defetishize the dice, just use all the pretty ones. Like my game playing Nature's Year is about what games, playing Nature's Year, is about games are for everyone. What if we had to use all the identical dice all the time? What if every single player needed 10 identical dice? So, yeah, design on purpose.
Design to play?
Yeah, I know, but we're good. We have 15 minutes until 2025.
Yeah.
What does what if yourself out of conventionality?
That's a great thing. So I was working on Dogs in the Vineyard, and I was driving back and forth to work. At this point, I had an office job, and I was working full time and designing games, and you were working with Mother One, so. And I was so stuck on how this game should work. And then I said, what if? It was two dice instead of one die. What if you put forward two dice? And from that what if spilled out the whole game. Mm-hmm. And since then, this has become a real pillar of my design process to say, what if there were two GMs? What if the player is responsible for making all the rule calls for themselves? The GM isn't. You don't go to the GM for rule calls. You make your own rule calls for yourself. What if...
So one of the things about what if yourself out of conventionality is that you have your initial first draft of your game, right? You're like, this is what I think I'm doing. And then you have to like take advantage of those pieces when you're not actively working on the game. Vincent was doing this on the commute. And it's like, I'm thinking idly about the background. You know what I mean.
I was concentrating very hard.
Sure, but you're not in a place where you can actively, like you couldn't sit down and write. You're like, you're driving, you're in the shower, you are, you know, you're standing in line at the grocery store, something that where your brain is always busy on it. And you can take these little thought experiments like, all right, what if cards? What if I use cards instead of dice? What if Jenga Tower? Is Jenga Tower a thing? You know, all these things. And it allows you to do this place where this quick iteration, because you're doing it mentally, and you can try on a whole bunch of ideas around your game design, and then explore ones that seem fruitful when you have more time. And it will help you sort of get out of ruts. We all put ourselves in design ruts.
Thank you. Then came
2012, Western Mass Scene, The Forge, Gen Con, Iron Game, Chef, and other contests. Oh my God, the purpose of contests is amazing for inspiration. And also can help if you're looking toward learning that, like how to get a product from an idea to a product or project, from idea to product, game jams can help because if they give you the creative constraints and the timeline and deadlines and things like that, they're awesome.
It's been really interesting to watch the transition from contests to jams. Yeah. It's been very interesting.
Yeah, and use them as design prompts and creative constraints. I really like the jam culture more than the contest culture because it allows you to be spontaneous and without the sense of judgment, although there is a really valuable piece to have in your game before your peers to say, hey, what's good and what's bad?
Yeah.
And there's a piece, I think Tim might have been, it was either Tim Hutchings or Jason Morningstar, maybe, who there was a game, Iron Chef, a bunch of years ago, where there was a prompt. And this other designer wrote to me, or Paul Siege, saying, "I have this idea, but it doesn't fit the contest." It's just the same. Like, why? Go do that idea. The whole point is to inspire you. So yeah, we played a million Forge games. Do you want to talk about 316?
316, and it was the first time I'd really played Dungeons and Dragons at Gen Con 2008. I want to say. It was definitely Gen Con 2008. And Gregor Hutton's game 316 and that game of basic D&D invented Apocalypse World. That's why they wrote that. My friend P.H. Lee was running basic D&D, and I realized at some point during the game, a quarter of the way into the game or halfway through the game, that they had no planned outcome at all. they had created a situation that they were curious to see what we would do with without any investment in anything we would do with it. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh.
And then a playbook that showed up.
And well. Gregor Hutton's game 316, which is a great game, was very polarizing at the con, at Gen Con that year. And I read it immediately when I got home, and by the time I finished reading it, I was writing the first playbook for Apocalypse.
I played Buffy the Vampire Slayer because Julia Ellingbow, who also had a youngest kid the same age, little nursling babies, that's my youngest kid, said, hey, I kind of like this idea of role-playing, but I've never played one. Would you run Buffy the Vampire Slayer for us? And I said, sure, but only if I can run it whatever wacky, strange way I did. And I did, and it was great. And then a couple years later, she wrote Steelaway Jordan. And that, to me, is a trajectory thing of use your whole self and go for it.
Oh.
2006 to 2012, our life together, grief, loss, homeownership. I lost 6 members of my family between the October of 2005 and September of 2007, and we bought a house, and I had our youngest kid. So that was kind of a fog.
Yeah. But the crucial thing there was at the end of that period in 2010, Apocalypse World came out, mm-hmm. and that. I mean, you can see how productive we were during those 5 years.
Games we created, 1001 Nights, In a Wicked Age, Poison, Siren, Storming the Wizard's Tower, Unfinished, Apocalypse World, and our kids' freeform games. Do you want to talk about division of labor and access to downtime with computer, or do you have to take that?
Go for it.
All right, so this is a thing I'm on. In order to create, you need space and time. Like Virginia Woolf famously talks about this. But in our world, in the last 30 years, we're beginning to see a transition from who has access to downtime at a computer where they put their words on paper and who does not, right? Because if you, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, and early 2000s, if you were of the demographic that had a job where you worked at a computer that occasionally had downtime where a program had to run, or you had to wait for that report, or you were waiting for someone to get back to you, you had paid downtime with the opportunity and access to get your words on paper. And this is an incredible space that is not the same for every demographic. So that was huge.
And in this period, 2006 to 2012,
I had 3 little babies.
You also had the internet.
Yeah.
If I was sitting at a desk at work, not only could I put my words on paper, I could also connect online with a bunch of people who shared my demographic.
So that piece that we talked about earlier in terms of in it for the long haul, where you can connect with all kinds of different communities and you balance your partnerships with what investment you make when, there's also a piece of making that mindfully and on purpose with what your division of labor is. And this can be around creative partnership where you are 3 people and you know that you have different roles within that partnership, or it can be in a family, and just trying to be mindful of what the division of labor is and when it happens. This has served us very well coming into the 2012 end of things when, you know, Apocalypse World is coming through or other games are coming through, where we have an ability to say, I need to work on this game now. And Vincent will be like, all right, then I'm doing what I'll take the kids and we'll do whatever. Luckily now they're all grown, but I remember those days very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, also award-winning game designer. I'm starting to get awards.
Sorry, how did that change things?
Which part?
The award-winning game designer
part. Oh.
It was pretty rad, I gotta tell you.
It's Docks in the Vineyard.
Docks in the Vineyard. It didn't. I will definitely say that if we're talking about the Diana Jones Award, I will definitely say things I shouldn't record for the internet.
All right, we're not gonna.
I was a runner-up for the Diana Jones Award in an extremely political situation.
Live on the internet.
As Apocalypse World won awards, we were
being brought internationally as guests of conventions. We did conventions in Italy, several conventions in Italy. I went to Ropicon, I went to Fosterball,
So here's the piece where I'm gonna say.
I would recommend it to anybody. It was a good time.
So show up, be a good human, weather the storm. Like if you wanna stay in it for the long haul, crappy stuff will happen. You will run into printer delays. You will run into your social circle exploding, either very publicly or very privately. You will run into personal or interpersonal stuff you have to focus on that takes you away from this work for an hour or a decade. And that is true. Show up, be a good person, weather the storm, if you want to stay in it for the long haul.
Winning awards fractured our community.
Yeah, big time.
That competition, you know, the contests stressed our community. The awards from outside stressed our community. There are still bad feelings about winning awards and losing awards. And
who got to be a judge, who got nominated.
This horrible,
suddenly,
can I tell you?
Oh my God, does you know how much it costs to enter the Emmys?
There was an award. I don't know if it still exists, but I'm not going to name it. There was an award that me and my friends collectively decided didn't matter anymore the year that Meg was up for it, and so nobody voted.
Am I bitter? Not really. I'm really not bitter. But it does circle back to that piece about access and social capital and who gets listened to and who doesn't. Because if there's a people out there like, oh, award-winning game deserve, world won all these things, like, okay, y'all, because you didn't vote for me when I was up for it. You know? So you have, that's another piece of weather the storm, right? It's really fine. It really is fine. Because you have to be in this for the long haul, you have to be able to be, at some level, content in yourself. You know, if I wind up going back to, eventually, I hope someday I go back to, like, I'm just going to create worlds in my notebook. You know, there's a space for that. Yeah.
We learned a bunch of lessons. That feeling is terrible that it's always right. That's about playtesting. There's a sucky feeling when you think your game might be okay, actually, but you know that it's not deep down. And that feeling is always right. And you should always, like, weep bitter tears because of that feeling. This is a saying from somewhere else. I don't know where. Success takes 10 years, overnight success takes 20 years.
I know, I heard it from Joshua.
Yeah.
And then we've got it.
Oh, I gotta talk about people wanting to cut themselves into your success. Okay, so Dogs in the Vineyard, it's winning awards, it's a popular game. I am selling this, these were big numbers in 2007 or whatever. I was selling about 1,000 books a year, you know, 800 to 1,500 books a year, something like that. And because I was producing it myself, my margin on that book was tremendous. It was going for $22, of which 4 to 6 were printing costs. And so I'm making,
well,
you see what I'm saying?
Part of the reason for that was the trade-off we made to have people at home, like, because I did fulfillment.
A game company came around, and I'm not sure they're still in existence, but I am comfortable saying their name on the internet. Mongoose came around looking for indie creators to publish their books, and I said, well, maybe, like, I know my cut of that book, my royalties will be a lot less than what I'm making now, but maybe they'll move enough products to make up for it. So I said to them,
what are the numbers?
How many would you expect to sell in a year? And they said to me, well, you have to understand, Vincent, that in this business, selling any is an accomplishment. And when I said, thank you, no thank you, I already sell any, they said I was being unprofessional and unrealistic.
Yeah.
Anyway. Look out! People will try to cut themselves into your success.
Not only will they try to cut, they will. I mean, that is some crappy nonsense bullshit to say. Well, you're being unprofessional and unrealistic, and you should make sure that I get all my fair cut of your work because I deserve it. Because you are being unprofessional and unrealistic, little lady. And Bullshit. Oh, everything is game design. Don't forget.
Oh, yeah, no, everything is game design. So that brings us almost to the present. The Western Mass scene has grown and shrunk. The Forge went away. StoryGames.com happened. G+ and Twitter now has come.
We take a moment of silence for G+. Thank you all. Appreciate that.
There was this beautiful explosion of conventions. Before this period, we were basically only doing Gen Con. Game contests turned into game jams. Our kids, the Baker House Band is our kids, started bringing their friends over every Friday night to play games. We've had young people.
Mary's 27.
Yeah.
So this is a 15 years. For 15 years, our house is filled up with teenagers every Friday, except for the pandemic. It's my favorite thing. I love them all. And it leads right over into like the years I spent teaching LARP at the middle school, high school, and you know how much I like working with young designers and young people.
Our kids started taking their first steps into game design, really. Tales of Timberwind and Haunted in them.
And like, I think we're harder on our kids than we are on other people we mentor and work with, because, you know, I think we are. Sorry, kids.
We
gave you the course of game design.
I had a policy for a while, which was that you don't charge money for student work. And I don't know if that's correct, but somehow that was my ethic when our kids were here.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things with Metatopia and like other long, you polish that, you get that done. And that's one of the reasons Metatopia is so valuable and your playtesting groups are so valuable and things like that. And my God, get it done before you crowdfund it. Get it done. There's a wonderful, wonderful world we live in now where there's tons of games going on for game jams and things. Like, here's an idea. I wrote it in afternoon, and I'm like, that's freaking great. Go write something that's 50 pages that digs into that and like really expands on. You do that to me all the time. I'm like, here's my game. It's done, and you're like, Meg, it's 8 pages. You need to this part and this part and this part.
But it's not because it's 8 pages. Like, we all publish 8-page games.
Oh yeah, I know. We should. And we should pay to 1-page games and like postcard size games.
And
it's just a thing of like.
Like, unexamined, I said to our darling children, we don't charge money for student work. But having examined that, I think that might be bad advice. I think maybe in this world we should charge money for our student work. Maybe we should. They charge money for our student work. They charge money. Anyway.
Life Together 2013 to 2019. I've been working in museums for a lot. Yeah, that's a whole other type. Like, it all comes full circle, right? Storytelling as a young kid is, and then this whole game design thing, and then storytelling museum. Everything I'm doing is how do I find and elevate an underrepresented story? And like, how do I put those principles that we talked about earlier of like, what is my insight into the human condition? What is my insight into my subject matter? And what is my insight into how that subject matter gets conveyed? That's what leads me to be a really good exhibit designer and a pretty good role-playing game designer. So, yeah.
2016 was the year that we kickstarted Apocalypse World 2nd Edition, and I was able to take the layoff at work. There were massive layoffs at work. They were going to lay me off anyway, but I took it.
So that's a piece of the In It for the Long Haul of, my goodness, don't quit your day job. I'm sorry to say, but don't quit your day job. And it's really okay if you work a bunch of different jobs, and it's really okay if you have a career that you love that makes money that allows you to do this on the side.
Yeah. So that had been 16 years since we started.
Yeah.
Publishing games.
I want to... mental health, ADHD, et cetera, and games week related. Yeah, it's just part of the continuing work of communication and life together is recognizing when it's a problem and when you're like, oh, I have to step back from this for a minute and take care of something. And when you have something that you need to take care of elsewhere in your life, a person or a place or something else that drives your attention. And if there's a piece from that I can suggest is be grateful for that because any place that you have it that like you get bitter about, like, oh man, I really could be going to conventions, I really could be going to, you're doing something else in your life right now, and there's lessons there that will help you and feed you and be part of your game design in the future. So embrace that.
In around 2018, I pulled Dogs in the Vineyard because I could no longer morally stand to publish that game, no longer morally stand for that game to exist. Mm-hmm. And
we could do that because we owned it.
We could do that because we owned it. Because no one, I didn't have to negotiate that with a single person. I decided one afternoon that I was going to pull it, and by 6 o'clock, it was no longer available for sale. And that, to me, is as powerful as the, you know, the margin I get, as the creative control I have, is to be able to say, that's it, that a game is no longer.
We've had occasions where people have been like, you know, you really have to have that press, you owe it to the everything, and we're like, excuse me, no.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And then, are you ready?
Sure. The rest of the slide says take critical advantage of contest jams and bundles. We talked about that. If you find yourself with a hit on your hands,
I would love your advice.
All right. So here we are at the last bits, 2020 to present.
Chaos and Ruin, as we all know.
Yeah, that's 2016 and what happened then. In 2020 and what happened then, okay, among other things. Our creative communities included the Western Mass social scene and game scene, a lot of collaboration with academic institutions. Talk to me later, I get spicy about that. The thing earlier where like there were not game design tracks, it was not possible. And now it is possible, and that's amazing, and I'm excited, but also, wow, is there work to do, my dear friends in academia, to bridge that there is, we know culturally across everything, we know there can be a white tower that it does not come into the practical. I face this in my museum work and I see it in game design. Mentorships are wonderful, I love doing that.
And now we're back going to cons, which is wonderful. Our kids, the Baker House Band has been much better able to maintain their regular gameplay than we have as adults. But it is great having them playing games in our house, even still. And they're stepping now into the family business.
Our daughter Meredith and our son Elliot are both in games here and playing games and running games here. And it's pretty darn awesome. And Toby is like, yeah, not yet.
We have some games and lessons we're trying to learn. We would love to design for online play. Something is changing, and there's a medium out there that we do not have, that I don't have insights into, and I need them. I need them if I'm going to stay.
It's a very different thing. Like playing on Zoom for 2 hours is very different than playing at a table. And there are ways that we can design for that space and that time, and there's not a lot of games that have done that, so I'm excited for that.
We have noticed that the kids' groups, they don't remember how to do it. And onboarding for people returning to play, that can be part of games.
In person.
Yeah. That there are social skills that we've lost, that we've forgotten, or gone out of practice.
They become a little atrophied for the last couple of years. And how do we scaffold?
There's an opportunity for games to help bring us back together. We want to build bridges to academic communities. We want to design for larger groups.
All the time. We design games for like 3 to 5 players. Mm-hmm. And then all the time, there's like, okay, but we have 8 people.
Yeah.
I ran Cyron, my game Cyron, for 12 people. What the heck? It was ridiculous. So designing for large groups, designing for convention play is a big deal, one-shots, but also, and expanding the demographic. Do you want to talk about that?
We're out of time.
Mm-hmm. All right, so questions, answers. We've been creating and publishing our own games for almost 25 years. How, why, what does it take? Why self-publish instead of shopping your work around? How do you plot your own course, build your own audience, measure your own success? This is about being you, the designer, making your games, owning the fruits of your labor, and keeping both your drive and your passion while holding down a day job and maintaining your relationships. Thank you so much. Other questions?
Yeah. So this is one of the things that you skipped over, but this is years ago. So what was the, and this might be getting into the major part actually, but what was kind of the process of kind of with Mango now, like welcoming the other people to use the system?
Yeah, great question. It's about like discovering PB, like Powered by the Apocalypse. How did we find that toolbox, make that toolbox, open up that toolbox? And well, that is our 8 o'clock panel.
It's not. I'm going to talk about the technicalities of PBTA, so okay. Let me answer that here.
Okay.
We started distributing our playtest material in 2008, late 2008, early 2009. And by the time Apocalypse World came out in 2010, Dungeon World was underway, Tremulous was underway, Blades in the Dark was not. The Regiment was what John Harper was working on. Monster of the Week, maybe Monster Hearts, I can't remember. So by the time Apocalypse World came out, it was already almost a race to be the first one out with BBTA. We knew what we had.
Because of the creative communities that we were designing with at that time, you know, there were D plus community, still the people that we were still talking with. We are still talking with, but like the people, our design cohort friends, were like, hey, here's a thing I'm working on, will you check it out? Instantly, oh, hey, this is going to do a thing. And then we had some ethical decisions that we made based on our like shared labor ethic and time and attention things of, and coming from poor backgrounds ourselves, to be like, hey, if this is a toolbox that could make it easier for non-dominant voices, people who have been marginalized, to be more comfortable coming to the table with a game design, we want that. And if it makes it easier for them to breathe at the grocery store, we want that.
Yeah.
So
Time a PBTA game made somebody enough money that they could pay rent or go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing like that feeling to be part of. To be part of an anarchist economic project.
Disruptive
like that.
Thing that we're doing.
There's
so
nothing like
thank
that
you
feeling.
For that. We just got a 2-minute signal. Is there another question?
I got one. So, doing design, having a day job, a lot of times you put the project down for a little bit and you come back to it, but then you come back different.
Yes.
So do you have any advice when you come back different and that you have maybe different goals or like some things don't fit? Do you have any advice for coming back to a project that
when you've done design work and you've had to step away for some reason, and how do you deal with changes when you come back? I mean, sometimes that game gets shelved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a game that's on the shelf right now because there's insights I have that I'm like, oh, that's not what I wanted. Sometimes it means you have to break it down into its parts again, like Legos, and rebuild.
Our friend Suzanne, who's a novelist, she always said the swamp provides. She
the
has an idea that
provides.
Doesn't pay off. She sinks it into the swamp.
Yeah.
Later on, the swamp.
Yeah.
But I've found on occasion I've gone back to a game knowing how to finish it and not caring anymore to finish it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Yeah.
Let it go. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I have game designs that I have them, I know I can do them, I'm just waiting for the mechanic to show up.
Mm-hmm.
I need to play a bunch of games, so I'm like, oh, that's what I can inspire me, that's what we can do with things. So that happens too.
Yeah.
We would clearly talk for a long time. Find us, we're around.
Yeah, please come up to us, never hesitate
I'm the
to come
only
up
McGay
to us.
I'm the only McGay Baker on the internet. If you find that, it's me, and you can get up with me. There you go.
Thank you very much.
I'm okay. It's not wrong. Can I just yank this wire up?
Yeah, it is.
My wife's going to come here 20